After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Joseph Goldstein Insight Hour. This podcast is an expression of our shared interest in self-discovery. Join Joseph as he shares his deep knowledge of the path of mindfulness. If you are interested in supporting this podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/Joseph.
The last 2 weeks, we've discussed mindfulness of the Dhamma with regard to the first two hindrances, that is, desire and aversion. Tonight, I'd like to examine the third of the hindrances. And it's one that at different times can be very strong in our practice and in our lives. And these are the mental states, the mental factors of sloth and torpor. Now, these two factors, sloth and torpor, are actually distinct mental qualities, but they're closely related and they always arise in conjunction with one another. So we'll look just very briefly at the distinction between the two, but mostly we'll be talking about them as a pair. So this is from the Satipatthana Sutta. This is the instruction about working with these states. If sloth and torpor is present, one knows there is sloth and torpor present in me. If they are not present, one knows there is no sloth and torpor present in me. One knows how unarisen sloth and torpor can arise, how if it has arisen, it can be removed, and how a future arising of sloth and torpor can be prevented. Well, this is the Buddha's instruction. Now, how to apply that? Sloth is that mental factor which is a sluggishness of consciousness, the sluggishness of mind. It dispels energy. There's a lack of a driving power, a moving forward. It's a kind of sinking mind. So it's interesting to me how sometimes different animals represent mind states. Of course, there is the animal of the sloth, which I'll talk about later. But another animal which captures this quality of sluggishness of mind is a slug. Now, and you know how it just kind of creeps along. It's a good representation. Torpor is that quality of mind, which is a weakened state of the mental factors. So here the distinction is between consciousness, sluggishness of consciousness, and sluggishness or enfeeblement of mental factors. When torpor is present, it's like the different mental factors get very unwieldy. They're not pliable. They're not agile. And the example given is just like a heavy blanket smothering all the different factors of mind. So we experience that in a very familiar way as kind of a drooping or a sinking or a nodding. So sloth has to do with sluggishness of consciousness, torpor has to do with sluggishness of mental factors. The mind, when it's conditioned by these states, it's described as inert as a bat hanging on a tree, or as molasses cleaving to a stick, or as butter too hard and congealed for spreading. You know, so you get this image of just hardness and congealed quality. So the first step in the Buddha's instructions is to know when these states are present in us and when they are not present in us. And generally, this isn't so difficult to do. And generally, if we're nodding, by the time we're nodding, we know it. But sometimes we can miss the arising, the first arisings of it. You know, just as sloth and torpor begins to creep into our minds, we may miss it, or we may be in a kind of denial that it's there. One time I was doing an interview, and this is really the only time in all these years of teaching, but it stands out in my mind. I was sitting doing an interview, somebody had come in, and I was just nodding off during the interview. And I just kept... And this poor yogi, I said, Joseph, are you sleepy? Oh, no. So that's denial. The question really for us is when the sleepiness or the sloth and torpor begins to come into the mind, of how quickly we can recognize it. Now, how quickly to become aware, yes, these states are present in me now. Sloth and torpor, the sleepiness, the dullness, of course, all these are common, quite common, at the beginning of a retreat. You know, when people come in from the busyness and activity of their lives and then come into the silence of a place like this where there are very few distractions, very often the first few days the mind is really very much influenced by sloth and torpor. Because in our lives we're going on the energy of stimulation mostly. You know, there's so much stimulation of all the senses. And that's the energy we move on. Here, that's been removed, and so, to a large extent. And so we, in a certain way, are suffering withdrawal symptoms. You know, so we're nodding off, there's dullness. One of the things you may have noticed in your time here, it's like when we first come, and sloth and torpor are stronger in us, there's the feeling maybe of not really getting alert until sometime later in the day. You know, all the morning hours, like the mind's still asleep. And then maybe by 4 in the afternoon, it has an hour or two of alertness. And then by 7 or 8 at night, again, ready to fall asleep. And most of you probably don't go to sleep at 8 o'clock, you know, at home in your lives. But here, with the lack of stimulation, the sloth and torpor come back. But what happens as we connect with that deeper energy source within us, as we work through those first days, you know, stimulation withdrawal, and we begin to connect with Dharma energy, the energy of this mind-body system, I think fairly common experience is that we begin to feel alert earlier in the morning, you know, and maybe stay alert later at night. So that's the sloth and torpor that comes in the beginning of a retreat. But as you know, these states are not limited to that time. After we've settled in, you know, after you've been here for a while, you have connected somewhat with the energy flow of this system. And if you're running on that Dharma energy, still we have the experience at different times when the sloth and torpor, the dullness, the sleepiness hits us. And it may come randomly, you may notice that it comes at particular times in the day, you know, maybe particular activities. There's a more subtle aspect of sloth and torpor, more subtle than these bouts of dullness that arise, either at the beginning of a retreat or randomly afterwards. And this more subtle kind of sloth and torpor is harder to recognize. Often it's influencing us and we don't even know that it's present. This deeper manifestation is the pattern in the mind, the tendency in the mind to withdraw from difficulties. It's the habit of mind that retreats from challenges rather than engaging with the difficulty, rather than moving forward and engaging with the challenge. So in that sense, it's said to be like, this is not said in the suttas, but it's said to be like reverse gear of a car. You know, that's just moving backwards, it's not moving forward. When this manifestation of sloth and torpor is present, this retreating from difficulty mode, not wanting to deal with them, it strengthens the tendency, or strengthens the patterns of laziness, of inactivity, of lethargy, complacency. You know, when this kind of sloth and torpor is present, there's no energy to do anything. There's no energy to accomplish something. There's not much vigor in our lives. At these times, sloth and torpor, which might not even be manifesting as sleepiness, it's just that pulling back quality. At those times, these factors work to prevent us from drawing on the energy that we actually have. Well, it's not that the energy isn't there, but when sloth and torpor are present, we don't have any interest in accessing it. Sometimes this complacency of mind, this pulling back, this withdrawal, happens on very obvious levels. Sometimes it's happening on quite subtle levels in our practice. So one example of this could be at those times when everything is really going very well. Everything is flowing along effortlessly, you know, and we feel quite good about that. But because at that time, no obvious effort is required, we can be lulled into a kind of cruise control. We were just going along, we're being carried along, things seem to be going well. And that very lulling is a kind of sloth and torpor. You know, it's a kind of lethargy in a very subtle way that actually keeps us from opening further. We're coasting in our practice, even when it's in a relatively good state like that. We're coasting rather than abiding in a very alert and present vibrancy of mind. There's a difference. Once sloth and torpor takes over, once it really comes into the mind and is there for a while, in whatever form, whether the obvious form of the sleepiness and dullness and nodding or the subtle form of coasting, the tendency of sloth and torpor is to hold on tight, not to let go. The example here, going back to the our animal imagery of the three-toed sloth, I read in this natural history book, you know, describing the animal, how it can hold on to the branch of a tree, you know, it just hangs there, and you could fire a gun next to its head and it wouldn't turn its head. You know, it's so slothful. So that's what it's like. That's what these factors are like in the mind. It's very cozy and very comfortable. You know, it's the mind that in the morning loves the snooze button on the alarm clock. You know, instead of, the alarm goes off, we're awake, we're alert, we're ready for the day, engaging. The alarm goes, just the snooze button, another few minutes, just let me stay in this really warm, comfortable state. Know that when that happens, see if you can be mindful, sloth and torpor, manifesting its nature. These qualities of mind also don't care very much for energetic people. One time I was on a retreat in Australia with Sayadaw, and across the hall from me was a very energetic yogi. You know, I was working pretty hard, I thought, but I'd go to sleep, he'd still be up. You know, and I'd get up in the morning, he'd already be awake and practicing. So, of course, I had endless self-judgment about myself and my practice. But then it started to be projected onto him. You know, I just projected all my self-judgment on him and started seeing all his faults, you know, and how, he was just pretending to be this good yogi, and, you know, why was he showing off? But then finally, in a moment of clarity, I saw all of that was quite impersonal, and it was just the voices, really, of sloth and torpor in my mind in response to energy. Now, sloth and torpor doesn't like energy. And as soon as I saw it in that impersonal way, and so, yeah, this is not I, this is not mine, this is not myself, the whole situation became just a lot lighter, you know, and humorous, and also inspiring. Sort of then I could connect more with the greater energy in myself. When sloth and torpor, this heaviness of mind, this inertia of mind, this withdrawing from challenges, when the mind is contracted under the influence of these factors, and they're impersonal factors, they don't belong to anybody, they're just functioning in their own way. But when these factors are strong, there's not much joy, there's not much delight in our lives. There's not much delight or pleasure in our practice, because we're always holding ourselves back, or we're always pulling back. So the first step is to simply recognize in the various ways that I've described, or you know from your experience, the first steps are to recognize, is sloth and torpor present? Is it not present? And there's something very valuable about that simple recognition, because when we become familiar with the mind influenced by this dullness, and we learn to recognize the mind free from that dullness, we are really learning something about ourselves. We're learning something about our minds when we see the difference between these two states very clearly. After we recognize the simple presence or absence, the next step that the Buddha talked about in the Satipatthana Sutta is to know the conditions for the arising of sloth and torpor. What are the causes that give birth to this state of mind in ourselves? The main condition for the arising of sloth and torpor that's given in the text, and it's actually quite surprising, has to do with the wisdom factor. And the Buddha said, frequently giving unwise attention giving unwise or careless attention to certain states, like discontent, like boredom, like laziness, like drowsiness caused by overeating, like depression, or a sluggish state of mind. It's when these states arise and we give unwise attention to them, that is the cause, that unwise attention is the cause for sloth and torpor to arise and spread. So this unwise attention could mean different things. It might mean, as these different states that I mentioned arise, it might mean thinking, oh, there's no harm in that, there's no problem. You know, they're not going to really be a hindrance to my practice. So if there's disinterest or boredom or whatever it is, we don't take care with them and see the possible hindering ability of them in our practice. Or there might be indulgent kind of thoughts, you know, unwise reflection in terms of the indulging thoughts, I'm really tired, or this is so boring, or thoughts of that nature would just reinforce the state and are an invitation for sloth and torpor to get stronger. Last week, in the last 2 weeks, we talked about how different thoughts can trigger emotions like desire, like anger. You know, and so we explored a little bit the relationship of thought to emotion. But we don't usually think of sloth and torpor as an emotion. But in the larger Buddhist kind of understanding of all of these as being mind states, we can see that thoughts also condition the mind states of sloth and torpor. So we want to watch our minds, watch the kind of thinking patterns we have around them. When there's unwise attention, it feeds them. Sometimes we are fooled into this unwise or careless attention, because sloth and torpor can masquerade as compassion, particularly compassion for oneself. Now, we might feel tired, we might feel bored, we might feel restless, and then sloth and torpor comes in the guise of compassion. If I work too hard, I'll probably get sick. Let me take care of myself. Or, I'm pretty tired. A little nap will be just the thing. Be good to yourself. Yeah. And so it's these thoughts that, you know, sound very caring and warm and compassionate and kind, but they may be sloth and torpor in disguise. There are times, of course, when we do need rest. You know, and so it's to be discerning of when that's the case. But very often, it's not. I'll just give you one example. It's a story I've told often from my past yogi experience in India when I was studying with Goenkaji. You know, and in his retreats, we would get up at 4 in the morning and have a 2-hour sit before breakfast. So I would get up, my alarm clock would go off, I'd get up, I'd jump right up because I wanted a place next to the wall in the meditation hall. You know, so I'd kind of get dressed quickly and rush into the hall and find my space against the wall. I'd start sitting. And then after 15 or 20 minutes, I'd start leaning back against the wall. And about 10 minutes after that, I'd be nodding. And this went on day after day after day after day. And then this voice started coming in. Oh, Joseph, this is stupid. Why come here and just sleep during the sitting? You might as well sleep. Get up, you know, just before breakfast. Then you'll be rested and you'll be alert for the whole day. So that was the voice. But I didn't listen to it. I just kept going. It was mostly peer pressure. But I just kept going and going and going. And amazingly, one day I went in there and my mind was totally alert. And if I hadn't gone through that period and just be willing to be with it and to sit through it, I wouldn't have gotten to that point. So be watchful. You know when it is that you actually need rest and know when it's sloth and torpor disguised as kindliness. Another aspect of unwise attention is when we don't acknowledge very difficult emotions that might be present. Because sometimes things are arising and they may be quite traumatic, you know, something very strong. And the sloth and torpor can be a kind of defense against feeling it. We don't want to feel that painful emotion. And so then sloth and torpor comes in, you know, as a way of not feeling it. But here, care is needed, particularly with powerful repressed feelings and emotions, because sometimes sloth and torpor actually acts as a kind of regulator, you know, for how much and how fast it's all coming up. So there are times when it's actually slightly protective in those cases, particularly of old trauma. But for most of us, and for the more usual run-of-the-mill emotions, sloth and torpor, if it's coming in and functioning in that way, you know, to just cover it so we don't have to feel something unpleasant, the sloth and torpor itself can become a signal. Okay, is there something going on here that I don't want to feel? Don't make a big project of this, you know, and don't overanalyze. And it's not that you necessarily have to go digging for some emotion that is there. Just hold it very lightly. Hold this possibility lightly. And in times when you're feeling the sleepiness or the dullness or the heaviness or the quality of retreating from things, you know, pulling back, just in a very light way, take a look. Is there some emotion there, some state, maybe some physical state that you don't want to feel, that you're avoiding? So the third cause for the arising of sloth and torpor, something that's not surprising, and that is overeating. Notice how you feel just after you take food and see the relationship of this sluggishness or heaviness of mind and body. See the relationship of it to the amount of food you take. The Buddha suggested stopping 5 mouthfuls before being full. Well, it's a challenge to know exactly when that point is, you know, 5 mouthfuls before. But just keeping it in mind keeps us more attuned as we're eating to the condition of our stomach rather than to the cravings and the urgings and the desires of our minds. Yeah, so it's a helpful place to be very attentive. And here, you know, it's also a possibility of exploring the benefit and the value of the 8 precepts of not taking food after the noon meal. On one self-retreat I was doing, this was before the forest refuge, I was just sitting in my house. I hadn't taken the 8 precepts formally. I was just experimenting with food in the evening. And so sometimes I would just not take anything. And at other times I would take just a very little bit. Really, very, very, very moderate, hardly anything. And I was astounded at the difference. You know, because I thought, I'm hardly taking anything. And yet when I sat, I could feel the depressed energy level from it. So it's something just to experiment with. Occasionally, sloth and torpor can come from not eating enough. In Burma, one time, and this was through a combination both of the diet, but also the, you know, very careful and mindful eating, I wasn't taking enough food. And I lost about 20 pounds, 25 pounds when I was there. I was getting so weak that my body actually would topple over. I would just be sitting, and then I'd just fall over on my side. So I reported this to Sayadaw. And it's the only time I ever heard him say, lighten up on your mindfulness. You know, he actually told me, don't be so mindful when you eat. You know, I was totally shocked. You know, just so that I would take enough food to sustain the health and energy of the body. So it's experimenting. It's just using, you know, all of these reference points to see what is the condition for the arising of sloth and torpor. You know, and what can we do so that it doesn't arise? And the last of the conditions for sloth and torpor that I'll mention is just the imbalance between concentration and energy. You know, if there's too much concentration, not enough energy, we go into the sinking mind. It's a dreamlike state. It's a reverie. It's very peaceful. You know, but we're in a dreamlike state. And so the sloth and torpor descend. These are some of the conditions for its arising. The Buddha then says, contemplate what to do when it does arise. How do we work with the state when it has already arisen? How to heat up this congealed mind, you know, this cold butter, molasses mind. How do we heat it up with some interest and energy and alertness? As with all of the hindrances, the first strategy and what's most emphasized in this sutta is to be mindful of it, where we take the sleepiness or the dullness or this retreating mode, we take that state itself as the object of our attention. Now we try to note it. And to note it as soon as it arises, to see how quickly we can pick it up. And then investigating, what is this experience that I'm calling sleepiness? So we don't dismiss it with a note or a word, but we're bringing the power of our investigative mind to it. What is the actual experience of this state I'm calling dullness or I'm calling heaviness? And doing that rather than just sinking into it. Notice the feelings in the body. You know, you've recognized sloth and torpor is present. What does it feel like in the body specifically? What does it feel like in the mind? Notice its contracting, its withdrawing, its sinking nature. Sometimes an obstacle to mindfulness of sloth and torpor is our attachment to clarity. Very often, I found myself that in the struggle, the wanting to be alert, the wanting to be clear, the wanting the mind to be bright, in the attachment to that, I'm so involved in that struggle that I'm not allowing myself to actually open to the state of sloth and torpor as it is, as it's manifesting. And I had a very powerful lesson in this 1 year practicing with Deepama, where during this was just a short 1 week retreat before the 3 month retreat. And she said, just sleep 3 hours a night and don't lie down during the day. You know, so that was a stretch for me. You know, 3 hours a night, don't lie down in the day, no naps. But then she said something else. She said, if you fall asleep when you're sitting, never mind. Okay, so that's what I did. And I was really tired, you know, often and many times during the day, and I would be nodding. But I didn't lie down. I slept only the 3 hours. But because of her last instruction, I stopped worrying about whether I fell asleep when I was sitting. She had given me permission. It was very interesting what happened because my mind relaxed in the experience of that state. And I began to explore a little bit. Okay, well, what is this sleepiness? I was not fighting with it, not struggling with it, but just going into it with as much awareness as I had. And sometimes I would nod off, but then I'd come back. And I found that there are actually some skillful states going on in the midst of it. Because generally when we're sleepy, the mind is calm. It's not agitated, it's not restless. So there's a calmness present. There's actually a kind of concentration present in sleepiness. You know, when there's not a lot of thought, if you're thinking a lot, you're probably not sleepy. You know, it's just that mind getting very, very quiet and calm. And if there's not enough energy, it goes to sleep. But if we can stay just there with it, with interest and not with struggle, it's almost like we pull the threads of the calm and concentration out of it, you know, and we focus on that. And it's possible to come to a very relaxed, open, balanced state. So again, it's just playing with it, being willing to be mindful of it. The great power of mindfulness here, just as with desire or anger, seeing that it's possible to be with all of these states when they arise, and we can stay with them, we can keep noting them or noticing them, and just by being mindful of them, we see that at a certain point, they go away. And so mindfulness here is giving us and deepening our insight into the impermanence of the hindrances. And if we can stay with it, we see they come and go by themselves. We don't have to fulfill the desire. We don't have to act on the anger. We don't have to indulge the sleepiness in order for them to go. We just need to stay with it. And we'll see their changing nature simply through the awareness of them. So mindfulness is the first and basic strategy for dealing with it. But mindfulness is not strong enough, you know, it's not strong enough to stay even moderately aware in times of sloth and torpor, the Buddha gave a whole list of other remedies. One is developing what he called clarity of cognition. And this means several things. It means developing mental clarity. Okay, how to do that when sloth and torpor is present? One way is to start adding more objects of meditation. So instead of just staying with the breath, which might be lulling you to sleep, add more objects, add touch points, you know, different touch points through the body. Add 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, you know, where you're really keeping the mind moving from point to point. There's a technique which Thangpu Sayadaw, he died quite a few years ago, but he was one of the great Burmese masters. He didn't lie down for 35 years. That was his remedy for sloth and torpor. But anyway, so one of his, talk about determination. One of his techniques, which I found very helpful at times, especially as an antidote to the sinking mind, he would suggest doing a round of hearing, seeing, sitting, touching. Right? So we're really moving from sense to sense. Hearing, seeing, internally or externally, sitting, the whole body, touch point. And it could be the same touch point each time, it could be different touch points. But moving the mind like that creates this clarity of cognition. It wakens us, makes us more alert. Another meaning of clarity of cognition is developing a radiant mind. Now, the word radiant comes up not infrequently in the suttas, and it's not always clear exactly what it means. But there's an interesting understanding that comes from the Tibetan use of the word, because in Tibetan, the word for radiant and knowing is the same. So really what it's referring to, radiance, doesn't necessarily mean, you know, shining light, but rather it means the radiance or the radiance, we could say, of consciousness, the radiance of knowing, the ability to know. And so this is very powerful. This is pointing to an essential nature of the mind, which is its ability to know what's ever arising. So in this context, we could say developing radiance of mind would mean focusing on the knowing aspect. So with sloth and torpor, you know, and it's kind of descending and we're sinking into it a bit. See if it's possible to turn the attention back onto the mind, which is knowing the sloth and torpor. So it'd be kind of like having fog or mist being reflected in a mirror. The reflecting power of the mirror is not affected by the fog. Right? That radiance of the mirror, that reflecting power, the knowing power, so to speak, that's untouched by what's being reflected. The knowing mind is untouched by what is being known. So in this development, you know, this clarity of cognition, developing a radiance of mind, we're actually looking at the knowing aspect, looking at the mirror, so to speak, instead of the mist, instead of the fog. Okay, if we do all this, and sloth and torpor is still strong, Buddha gave some other remedies. You see, this is not a new problem. You know, this is a major influence over the centuries. Helpful to open one's eyes. You know, there's less tendency to doze off and maybe to keep an upward gaze. And if that's not quite enough, I developed my own particular open eye technique. At one point, this was the first retreat I did with Sayadaw. We were just sleeping 4 hours a night then, and it was very intense. You know, it was a very kind of pressured retreat. He's softened a bit over the years, at least here. But anyway, I was just sluggish and nodding. So I just decided in one sitting, I was going to sit up very straight, open my eyes wide in a totally exaggerated way, just like a cartoon figure, you know, like toothpicks keeping the eyes propped open. So I was sitting like that. And it was very interesting what happened, because I could feel this cloud of sleepiness starting to come down. And I figured it descended. Everything in me wanted to close my eyes. Yes. The force, the desire to close my eyes was so strong. But I didn't. And so this, I could feel this wave of sleepiness come down, pass down to my face, into my body, and out. And then about 30 seconds later, another wave and the same strong urge to close my eyes, and I didn't. Out. This happened 3 or 4 or 5 times this way, and then it was completely gone. And it was such an incredible lesson in understanding that sloth and torpor is not this monolithic, unchanging state. It's an energy wave, but it's so seductive, you know, that the wave comes and we just, we just go right into it. So this was my open eye technique, which was very illuminating about the nature of the energetics of sloth and torpor and how we can really let it pass through as a wave. Okay, we're mindful, we've developed clarity of cognition, hitting touch points, focusing on knowing, you know, opening the eyes, opening it in this way. If it's still strong, you know, you try all this, change posture, stand up. Well, I don't know that I mentioned here, but there was one yoga teacher who said that he actually fell asleep in a headstand. So changing posture doesn't always help, but it's somewhat harder to fall asleep standing. Walk outside, you know, splash water on your face. And a remedy the Buddha suggested, which never quite worked for me, but maybe it will for you, is pulling one's earlobes. And I don't know if there's some kind of pressure point there or acupuncture point, but it's a recommendation. Okay, so these are some of the things we can do in working with sloth and torpor. There's another whole realm of remedy. It's a powerful remedy because it engages our thinking mind. And that is wise reflection. You know, one that engages our interest. You know, and arouses a certain kind of ardency. So one of these, of course, is the reflection on the precious human birth. You know, and I think you're all familiar with that reflection of just contemplating the rarity of the conditions that allow us to practice. You know, and it's particularly such a privilege to be able to practice in this kind of environment. And so just reflecting on that, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who was really one of the great masters of the last century, he said, "Ask yourselves how many of the billions of inhabitants on this planet have any idea of how rare it is to have been born a human being? How many of those who understand the rarity of human birth ever think of using that chance to practice the Dharma? How many of those who think of practice actually do it? How many of those who start continue? Once you really see the unique opportunity that human life can bring, you will definitely direct all your energy into reaping its true worth by putting the Dharma into practice." And so it's this kind of reminder to ourselves of the preciousness and rarity of the opportunity of practice. So sometimes that helps awaken our mind, awaken our interest. Another reflection which can be very powerful for us, not only on retreat, but also in our lives, is the reflection on impermanence and death. And here very specifically related to this hindrance, because at the time of death, very likely, not necessarily, but not unlikely, that our minds may be in a weakened state. You know, our senses will probably be more enfeebled. Our mind may be in a duller state due to the illness or the dying process. So how will we want to be at that time? You know, at this shutting down of the body, at the time of our death, what is our aspiration? It's very easy to say abstractly that, yes, I want to die consciously. I really want to be there for the dying process. I want to die with awareness. But how do we train for that? Each time sloth and torpor arises, which may be a state not dissimilar to how we feel at the time of our death, how are we relating to it? Do we take it as practice for dying? Can I be alert even in times of low energy? Can I stay mindful? Or do we just sink into it? Do we just indulge it? So this is the attitude of seeing difficulties and seeing challenges as something to meet, as something to engage with, rather than seeing the difficulties or challenges as something to pull back from or something to avoid. The last of the remedies for sloth and torpor that are mentioned are good friends and profitable talk. So here we're in a whole environment of good friends. You know, we're among fellow practitioners and we can inspire each other. You know, when we're feeling sluggish or tired or dull and we just want to retreat, and if we're not feeling too aversive at the time, we can look around and, you know, we might see some other yogis who are really being diligent and mindful and alert and aware, and it can help us and can inspire us. I had this situation in my early days in India. I was living at the Burmese Vihara. And there was this other guy across the little courtyard. This was unlike the Australia time. His life would be on all night. I'd be practicing till 12 o'clock, till 1 o'clock at night. I'd be ready for sleep. His life would still be on. And it inspired me. So I just got up and walked again. You know, and then I sit and then, okay, I'm ready for sleep now. Look across. His light's still on. If he's sitting, I'm going to sit. You know, it's kind of competitive sitting. It was amazing. It just stretched me. You know, I was inspired by his diligence. Because he might have fallen asleep with his light on. You know, I have no idea what was going on behind the door. But it served me. You know, and I think we serve each other in this way. And likewise, when we're feeling really alert, you know, and we're practicing well and we're being attentive, it's to recognize that we are serving others, that we become the inspiration for others then. You know, and it really brings to life this whole idea that our practice is not for ourselves alone. What does profitable talk mean in a context of silence? Well, there are times when, you know, just a little reading can be helpful. And this doesn't mean 6 hours with a book, but just, you know, just having a little hit of 15 or 20 minutes of reading the Dhamma can be inspiring. You know, or listening to a tape. Also sometimes chanting. You know, there's that little chanting room in the council house. If you're really sluggish, or very low energy, you've tried all these other things, that can really be arousing of energy and arousing of faith and arousing of confidence. It might be helpful for you to know that sloth and torpor is not eradicated from the mind until one is an arhant. So this is a very deeply rooted tendency. It's going to be around for a long time, which is why it's worth understanding in some detail and in a comprehensive way okay, how do we work with it? You know, how can we engage it so it actually becomes food for our awakening rather than just sinking into it as a hindrance? Moggallana, who was the chief disciple, one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha, he became fully enlightened after 1 week of practice. But he struggled in that week. You know, and he was sitting in the forest, and it said that his mind shrank and became withered, you know, and unworkable. And the Buddha came to know of this, you know, through his power of mind. And so the Buddha appeared, you know, spontaneously to Moggallana, and he said, "Moggallana, are you drowsy?" And Moggallana replied, "Yes, sir, I am nodding." And Buddha said, "Listen, I will teach you ways for overcoming it." And then he gave many of the things we discussed tonight. And the last thing he said, "And if none of these work, take rest." And so we try all this, we engage with, you know, all of these ways of working, and if still we're just really tired, so we take rest. Just one little suggestion in taking rest, something I've found very helpful. When I'm feeling really tired, sometimes I'll lie down on retreat. I'll lie down, but just until the point, you know, that moment where before you fall asleep, there's a moment, it's like everything lets go. There's that moment of relaxation. To lie down until that moment and then get up rather than then go into sleep. And what I found is that that really is what was needed. It wasn't the sleep. It was just that complete relaxation of mind and body. So that could be something else to explore as well. I'd like to close with something that Ajahn Chah wrote. He said, "I wish that you continue your journeys and practice with much wisdom. Use the wisdom that you have already developed to persevere in practice. This can become the ground for your growth, for the deepening of yet greater understanding and love. Understand that you can deepen your practice in many ways. Don't be lazy. If you find yourself lazy, then work to strengthen those qualities which overcome it. Don't be fearful or timid. If you are timid in practice, then work with your mind so that you can overcome that. With the proper effort and with time, understanding will unfold by itself. But in all cases, use your own natural wisdom. You come to where you have no more questions, to that place of silence, to the place in which there is oneness with the Buddha, with the Dhamma, with the universe. And only you can do that. From now on, it's up to you." So let's sit for a couple of minutes.